welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, speaking from Washington, D.C., and the spirit of Scrooge, the spirit, as Dickens rightly attacked it, it is the spirit of Bentham and the spirit of Malthus, the spirit of zero growth and of overpopulation and industrial pollution being the main problems of humanity, which they are not. The main problem of humanity is underproduction of all the necessary means of human existence. That has always been that way. It has not changed. The main problem of humanity, poverty, disease, illiteracy, backwardness, but above all, poverty, from which all the others grow, ignorance and want, as we saw in the Christmas Carol. So we've got the bailout of the automobile companies. Remember that AIG, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Mellon, Bank of New York, they got everything they wanted immediately, in the middle of the night. The bankers, the hyenas, the hedge fund jackals, the raptors, got everything they wanted without so much as a public appearance. There were no hearings. There was no discussion. $700 billion for openers. And now it's grown to more than 10 times that if you factor in all the other loans from the Federal Reserve and so forth. But if you're an industrial corporation, you will grovel. If you're in that dirty business of making positive improvements in this, in the order of nature for the purpose of human existence under this system, you are a pariah. You will grovel. This is very much like the Spanish Empire. Well, it's like many empires, but the Spanish one occurs to me at the moment. In the 1600s, of course, if you were a Hidalgo, a noble of the Spanish Empire, you couldn't work. What? Work? No. You had to be a parasite. Only parasites were allowed to rule in the Spanish Empire. This is one of the main problems of the French old regime, Ancien Régime, Louis XIV, and Louis XV, and Louis XVI, was that the nobility refused to work. So it meant that the political power was in the hands of people who hated work, hated industry, hated, well, today we'd say they hated industrial workers. Now, if you want to make a generalization of the current situation, what you're seeing is that the entire United States ruling class, the ruling elite of this country, and make no mistake, there is one. It's obviously, it's not a caste, it's not permanently determined, it's a floating crap game, people join it, people drop out, but there is a ruling elite. It's called finance oligarchs. Wall Street bankers are the center of it, and then their hangers-on in the political, government, and other areas. They hate production. They hate blue-collar workers. They hate production, they hate technology, they hate science, and they wish to destroy these things. Now, this is not a plan. It's not like there's some little room where they get together and say, hey, let's destroy industry, science, and technology. It is simply the eternal instinct of the oligarch. The oligarch can't do it any other way. And we know this going back to Hesiod and the earliest of the Greek poets. Remember, the reason the Trojan War was necessary was because humanity was oppressing the breast of Mother Earth. The world was overpopulated, said the oligarchs, in 1000 BC. So 3,000 years ago, the world was overpopulated. That was the oligarchical line. The same thing we find in the old oligarch from the Age of Thucydides. He says, we don't like the Athenian navy. We don't like technology because it provides upward mobility to the hoi polloi and tends to undermine the regime of oligarchical privilege which we need to create. Now, we're going to talk a bit in depth about the question of class consciousness, because people out there who have been duped by Milton Friedman and von Hayek and the Austrian school will say, well, there are no classes, are there? We're just individuals, aren't we? Well, no, there are classes. You betcha there are classes. And we've known this since Plato. Plato writes about oligarchy as a situation where there is a ruling class. That's what oligarchy means. It means that rule, power is not in the hands of one dictator, and it's not in the hands of a totally spontaneous mob, but it's in the hands of a class, and that is the class of, well, the wealthy, the rich, as Plato says. Oligarchy is the system where only the rich rule and the poor have no stake in society. Well, you're seeing what oligarchy looks like in a clinical, suicidal form. We're seeing the Götterdämmerung, the self-immolation of the Anglo-American ruling class on the altar of their own backwardness and stupidity. And, of course, it's expressed in the fact of Malthus, of Darwin, and of Bentham. And these are the things they believe in. And let's throw in Rousseau, because Rousseau is very big for them, too. We had been told most of this week that the Bush White House was working on a plan to preserve some vestiges of industrial production here in the United States. They did it, of course. They didn't want to do it, as Bush kept saying. This is not what he wanted to do. He didn't like doing it. He hates industry. He loves Wall Street. Remember, this is a family that comes out of Brown Brothers Harriman Investment Bank. His grandfather, Prescott Bush, was the managing partner of Brown Brothers Harriman Investment Bank, the most powerful investment bank in the world between the two world wars. It was Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and the rest of them all rolled into one, and they supported Hitler. That was also part of their plan. They didn't like Stalin and the five-year plans, so they wanted to play Hitler against that. But we were told all week that there was going to be a plan to possibly to deal with the automobile crisis, the crisis of industrial production, let's call it, because that's what it comes down to. And we were told as of Thursday that the Bush White House favored an orderly bankruptcy, which of course simply means that they would have presided over the death rattle of industrial production in North America and the beginning of the thermodynamic devolution, a thermodynamic breakdown crisis. Now, this is not a financial collapse like some stock market panic. It's not even a financial disintegration like 1931 or, say, in the United States, the banking panic of 1932 to 1933. This is now a one-way collapse of production, which has so far in North America not occurred, at least not on the scale that is being proposed here. So we're told this morning, we're recording, of course, on Friday, the 19th of December, we're told that there will be a plan. It's about $17 billion of short-term loans. It's on a 90-day review. There's a review in 40 to 50 days, and then there's another review in 90 days. And it means that loans will be delivered to General Motors and Chrysler during the final days now of 2008, and that other loans will be available. Ford claims they don't need the money immediately, but they would like to have it available as a line of credit. And, of course, this means at the very minimum that these companies are likely to survive into the new year. That is all that has been obtained at this point. It is totally inadequate. And, of course, the strings are not that the companies should destroy, shred, and delete all of their poisonous derivative instruments. No, it's going to be something singling out organized labor and labor in general. In other words, something expressing the hatred of the financier ruling class for blue-collar workers. Financier ruling class means Republicans and Democrats reaching across the aisle, as they like to say, in their hatred of production technology science and of the people that embody this, blue-collar workers. So it's open season on blue-collar workers, open season on industrial production, and this is the biggest crisis that anybody's ever seen in North America.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C., and the Advent season, the coming of Christmas and the year-end holidays, all dominated by the spirit of Malthus, Bentham, and Darwin, social Darwinism, zero growth pessimism, and it's expressed in the obvious desire of the U.S. ruling elite to use the derivatives crisis, which they created with derivatives, with structured investment vehicles, collateralized debt obligations, mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, commercial paper, you name it. They created the crisis using those derivatives. Now they want the United Auto Workers Union and other unions, the electrical workers, the Teamsters, and others who are also involved in auto, they want these unions to be busted. They want to get a pure sweatshop, low-wage model for North America. And people will say, well, I'm not a member of the UAW. Yeah, the fact that the UAW is there pulls your wages up, whether you know it or not. And you'll find that out if they disappear, if these trade union formations go under, you will be the poorer. You will be more defenseless. And you'll find that out when it's too late. So you can take your Chicago school Friedmanite doctrine and your Austrian school von Hayek doctrine and console yourself as you're sitting in the cold and the dark, maybe on Christmas of next year. You say, oh, gee, I wish I'd done something to save trade unionism and industrial production in North America. But then it'll be too late. And if in the meantime you demand the free market, you will be pitching into the ninth circle of the economic inferno. Well, that's where we're heading, in effect. We are in the middle, so to speak, of the winter of 1932 to 1933. We have a number of approaches on the table. One is the approach being followed by the Bush administration, and it has been pointed out that is pure Herbert Hoover. Pure Herbert Hoover. Remember, Herbert Hoover would not intervene by making payments to individuals, and he would not attempt to revive the economy as a whole. Rather, what he did was make payments to bankers. So Herbert Hoover, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, payments to bankers. Bush administration, the TARP, the various lending facilities of the Federal Reserve, and all the rest of it, payments to bankers, only to bankers. And you saw it again. If you're a banker, an investment banker, a hedge fund hyena, if you're an insurance company, a credit card company, a financial institution, if you deal in toxic paper, derivatives, loans, usury, then the government is here for you with cheap federal credit. But if you produce the means of human existence, then you're on your own. You can go down, and you're going to be loaded with opprobrium as you go down. So that's the situation. Now, of course, in 1932, 1933, we had the inestimable advantage that there was a real president waiting in the wings, Franklin D. Roosevelt. And please don't repeat the lunatic, idiotic cliches purveyed by Friedman, von Hayek, and the rest of them attacking FDR and the New Deal. A lot of the people who repeat those cliches today would never have gone to college. They would never have had a home of their own. They would never have the living standard that they're enjoying that allows them the leisure to read these crazy books if it hadn't been for the New Deal. That is the irony of the whole thing. After the New Deal, a lot of people said, well, I got mine. I got into the middle class. Now let's pull up the ladder and make sure nobody else can follow. That's bad policy, and it's immoral, right, from the point of view of the season here. That's Scrooge in practice, Scrooge Herbert Hoover. Now, in addition to Herbert Hoover, we've got Andrew Mellon. Andrew Mellon, of course, liquidate stocks, liquidate labor, liquidate banks, liquidate everything, liquidate, liquidate, liquidate. In other words, have a deflationary crash, and then there will be a recovery, you hope. Well, there was no recovery. We are now probably not going to see that one. What we're headed into now, I believe, is the hyperinflationary version or hyperstagflation and hyperinflationary depression. That seems to be the way it's pointing. The dollar has weakened by about 20 cents very quickly. A number of other indications point to the fact that we're going to have the 7 to 8 trillion plus of additional money that has been pumped in. That is going to be coming home to roost in the form of hyperinflation. So that's the possibility. Now, of course, the New Deal alternative is a theoretical one at this point because nobody has the brains to fight for it. They're all the people who should be fighting for it have been stupefied by the freedom agenda of Friedman and von Hayek, And what you should be fighting for, of course, is the immediate nationalization of the auto companies. Kick out the Wall Street stooges who are running them right now. Bring in competent industrial engineers. Maintain union wages with the goal of bringing everybody in the economy back to the traditional American high-wage model rather than making the entire country into a sweatshop for foreign employers from Japan, Germany, and other places around the world, Eurogarchs and other oligarchs from around the world. The one string you want to attach is destroy all derivatives. Cerberus capital has to go. Cerberus Capital is a hedge fund. It must be nationalized. It must be neutralized. It must be re-regulated. All the derivatives at General Motors Acceptance Corporation have got to be wiped out. Similarly for Ford, there can be no foreclosure of Ford under the legislation we need. All foreclosures are illegal. Any foreclosure of a home or a productive business is a federal crime and will be punished by a trip to Leavenworth to contemplate the virtues of the Austrian school. And therefore, nationalize, bring in competent managers, delete the derivatives, get rid of the hedge funds, and then reconvert into things humanity needs. I'd keep one-third, one-half making automobiles. That's fine for the moment, but then get into magnetic levitation rail, high-speed urban mass transit, tractor production for the third world, nuclear reactors and duplexes, airframes for space exploration and colonization, start turning out cities that are going to go on the moon. New science cities for the moon and Mars can be created in those Detroit factories. And that's the difference. Either you're going to be squabbling in the mud over busting the union, or you're going to be on your way to the moon and Mars. China is going, dear monetarists. How about you? Are you going too? The Chinese will be there and others will be there. But of course, the U.S. monetarist model, the oligarchical model, has now reached a point where the U.S. is probably incapable of doing this psychologically and industrially. And of course, the way you pay for all this, I would not use, I would use TARP money, if only to keep it out of the hands of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, but in particular, what you've got to do is seize control of the Fed, nationalize the Fed, kick out the clique of unelected, unappointed, unaccountable bankers that are there, 0.5% interest rates, 50-year maturities as needed to reconvert, and you have got an economic recovery. You can have an economic recovery any day, any time of day. You're willing to fight for it. Back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster's up here in Washington, D.C. Naturally, the goal of the Bush plan announced this morning, done by executive order, not by congressional action. This will basically take us 1 month, from the 19th, 20th through the 20th of January. So the last month of the Bush regime under this particular version, the Congress impotent, useless, Bush doing this, but with the included desire, he wants to try to do what he can to break the UAW and the other unions in the last month of his regime. I call now on the following people: Sweeney of the AFL-CIO, Hoffa of the Teamsters, Gettelfinger of the UAW, and Stern of the Service Employees International. I call on you to stage a one-day warning general strike. Shut down everything you can for 24 hours. This has been done by the Italians in the 1990s into this current decade. It's done repeatedly. It's done by the French. Any place there's a lively, healthy, vibrant trade union movement, once in a while they pull themselves together to flex their muscles with a general strike just to keep it's like summer maneuvers, right? It's a drill. So Sweeney, Hoffa, Gettelfinger, and Stern, call a general strike. Call a one-day general strike just to remind people that there is such a thing, and show your organizational power. You may say you don't think your organizational power is sufficient. Well, this is how you build it. And try doing it now. You can maybe do something about it so you'll have the weapon of a general strike in your quiver when you need it. But you cannot let the oligarchical ruling class of financiers and bankers, Paulson, Geithner, Summers, and Bush and Barkey, do this stuff, and nary a peep, no mass action, no nothing. I mean, is this a trade union movement, or is it a geriatric ward? Get the people out there. It'll do them good to walk around a little bit in the fresh air. So general strike is the only answer to this sort of machination. And, of course, it's a scandal they didn't do this back in October when the weather was better. Better time for a general strike. But any time is a good time for a general strike. And naturally, if you're a trade unionist and you see that Sweeney, Hoffa, Gettelfinger, Stern, and the rest of these labor skates and crats, if they're not calling for a general strike, what are they doing? What are they doing to earn their pay? So that's the one side. The other side, of course, is notice not a word from Barkey Obama. Not a word. Barkey Husseinovich Obama had nothing to say about any of this stuff, except then to once Bush had made the final decision, he endorsed it. But Obama fought for nobody. Notice this. Obama fights for Obama, not for anybody who supported him. And we'll go through this in just a minute. Let's look now at the Obama cabinet. Interestingly, the last one to be named, or almost the last, Hilda Solis, Secretary of Labor. She's of Central American ancestry from Los Angeles. I tried looking up Hilda Solis. One of the first things you find is that she appears at ACORN rallies rather frequently. So she's apparently part of the ACORN vote fraud machine. Maybe that's the payoff to ACORN that Hilda Solis comes in as Secretary of Labor. Now, you'll remember that the actual labor people wanted David Bonnier, former congressman from Michigan and an ally, for whatever it's worth, of the UAW, at least, in name, a formal ally of the UAW. So AFL-CIO and the rest of these people did not get what they want. Solis may also be the candidate of Andy Stern of the Service Employees International Union. So who else do we have? The White House is run by Rahm Emanuel, whose dirty role in the Blagojevich scandal is going to be discussed here in the second hour. You've got Hillary Clinton coming in with her crew at the State Department, although you've also got Susan Rice, the mad bomber of Khartoum, is coming in, and she's setting up a squabble already. There are two transition teams in the State Department. One is the Clinton one. One is the Rice one. Rice is a really nasty piece of work. She's actually going to make Clinton look like a magnetic figure. At the Pentagon, we've got Gates. We've gone through this before. The five things you need to know about Gates. He's a part of the taking of the hostages. Well, but in order, he's part of Iran-Contra, the deliveries of U.S. weaponry to the Khomeiniac regime. He's part of the taking of the hostages in Tehran in 1979 in order to cover those deliveries. He's a part of the October surprise negotiations to delay the release of the hostages, and he's the founder of Al-Qaeda, and he's an anti-Russian Soviet studies ideologue. So that's Gates, and he's a clone of Zbigniew Brzezinski. At the Treasury, we have Geithner, a tool of the U.S., the New York Wall Street banking community. Those are the big three. Also, the Attorney General Holder, dirty Mark Rich advocate. We've got Tom Daschle, the senator from Citibank at Health and Human Services. We've got Ron Cook, the mayor of Dallas, comes in as Minister of Economic Warfare, that is to say, U.S. Trade Representative. We've got a guy called Chu, who apparently is some kind of a green fanatic at the Department of Energy. He's taking over there. Lisa P. Jackson, another Malthusian fanatic at the Environmental Protection Agency. Carol Browner, another environmentalist fanatic left over from Clinton, will be a global warming advisor. Bill Richardson, Judas, coming in at Commerce. And then we've got the appointments, Mary Shapiro, Securities and Exchange Commission, and Gary Gumbs at Commodity Future Trading Corporation. Vilsack at Department of Agriculture, and LaHood at Transportation. LaHood is the guy who ran the House hearing to impeach Bill Clinton. How interesting. I guess it's a token of pan-oligarchism, right? The oligarchy is drawing together. They're showing class consciousness. The oligarchs are circling the wagons, and they're going to fight, and the blue-collar workers are their first target. Forget about party. Forget about this liberal conservative stuff. That means nothing anymore. Now that you're in the land of the tarp, there's no such thing as conservative ideology except for dupes and suckers. The nut roots over there at the Daily Kos are not happy with these cabinet picks. The thing that really gets them though is that now instead of having Billy Graham come, they're going to have Rick Warren come to the inauguration and give the invocation. So a right wing, basically fundamentalist preacher, and Elmer Gantry, a new look Elmer Gantry. And there are lots of people in the Obama coalition that are unhappy with that. Well, fine. Now you've understood what we were trying to tell you here all year, that Obama is a Wall Street puppet, a banker's boy, trilateral Bilderberger, Rand, Skull and Bone, Chicago School, you name it, it's Barkey. So this is the night of the long knives. Now, with Hitler, of course, the night of the long knives came literally in one night, right, with machine guns in June of 1934. Mussolini is a better example, as usual, with Obama. A gradual purging of left-wing elements, of labor elements, a gradual shift of the Mussolini dictatorship to the right. At a certain point, Mussolini says, "Il mondo va a destra," the world is going right. That's the process of 1922, 1923, 1924. That's what you're going to see with Obama. Now, the one we want to talk about is the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Rounding out the Barkey cabinet, Salazar at the Department of the Interior. No, not the Portuguese dictator, as far as we know. Not the Portuguese fascist. But, well, who knows? We're going to talk about Arne Duncan if we have time in the second hour. The union buster of Chicago. The privatizer, deregulator, union buster, and ultimately the destroyer of the Chicago school system. Because remember, Barkey's family business is to be a foundation operative. Barkey is a poverty pimp by trade, and the purpose of poverty pimps is you work with foundations to destroy trade unions and destroy the New Deal. Get the picture? The foundation sure do. Now, the other thing is, when Barkey presented Lisa P. Jackson for the Environmental Protection Agency, Carol Browner, of course, married to a big lobbyist, as well as Daschle, married to a big lobbyist. So the no lobbying pledge of Barkey has gone out the window in the middle of the night, along with so much else. There's a growing awareness now among the nut roots, right, the fanatical left liberals who were so blinded by their hatred of Bush that they couldn't realize that there was something worse in the world. They're now undergoing the night of the long knives on the installment plan. It's a combination of the Chinese water torture and the night of the long knives along the Mussolini model. When Barkey brought out Lisa P. Jackson for EPA and Carol Browner and the rest of these fanatics, he formally endorsed global warming. In other words, global warming created by human activity is now the compulsory doctrine of the Obama regime. And this, of course, is very bad. The irony is It comes in the middle of one of the coldest winters in many decades, right? We had forms of winter weather in Los Angeles that haven't been seen in many decades. We've got a tremendous ice storm in New England, another storm. It snowed here in Washington, D.C. about 2 weeks ago. So you look at the weather map, and what you see is global cooling. You see the beginning of a new ice age, perfectly possible, but mainly you have to conclude that you don't want to extrapolate from these very, very short-term tendencies. But Barkey has now taken the fateful step. In the case of the National Socialist regime, you had to believe in race science and the theory of Aryan blood. In the case of the Barkey-Obama regime, it is compulsory doctrine to believe in the fantastic fraud of global warming. Remember Barkey's meeting last week with Al Gore, the high priest of this new ersatz pagan heathen religion. And, of course, behind Al Gore, the shadowy figure of Prince Charles from the pro-Nazi British royal family. So you've got all that. Now, in terms of foreign policy, two things. Barkey, remember, is the one who called for the reckless bombing of northwest Pakistan. This was back in Chicago, July 2007, open-air debate. Barkey Obama demanded unilateral bombing of northwest Pakistan, bomb Pakistan to hell, talk to Iran, cajole them, be nice to Iran, turn them against Russia as a kamikaze puppet, of course. But in the case of Pakistan, work towards the destruction of the Pakistani central government. And since then, the Predator drones have been carrying their cargo of death. They've been attacking villages, wedding parties, any just individuals. When they're told that there are concentrations of guerrilla fighters who are fighting the Pakistani central government, they make sure they don't attack those. They wouldn't want to do that. They're trying to foment civil war in Pakistan. That's the new policy. And that is now generating a backlash, okay? We now know, we've talked on this program in the past years about the very, very tenuous supply situation of the U.S. in Iraq, because there your supply line goes for 1,000 miles across your enemy's front, if you want to look at it that way, enemy as defined then. In other words, through the Straits of Hormuz, up the Persian Gulf, all the way to the ports of Kuwait, and then the two roads, Route Tampa and so forth, for another 400 or 500 miles to Baghdad. So and then to the various places, right? And that's food, medical supplies, fuel, and ammunition. Now, you have the similar situation in Afghanistan. If anything, the situation in Afghanistan, of course, is worse, because there it's completely landlocked, and the principal way you get there is you send your supplies to the ports of Pakistan, and then they go up all the way through Pakistan, across the Khyber Pass, into Afghanistan. 300 to 400 trucks per day are necessary to supply the invading imperialist armies of the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan. And remember, what they're there for is to destroy the possibility of Eurasian unity, and specifically to destroy Pakistan as a country. That is the new goal of all this. But now, in the past couple of weeks, we've had repeated attacks by Mujahideen guerrilla fighters against the trucks. In other words, essentially the smart strategy: don't attack the combat units, attack the easy part, attack the relatively indefensible truck convoys. Hundreds and hundreds of trucks have been destroyed. We're told that if 300 to 400 trucks going across the Khyber Pass per day are necessary to supply the imperialist forces in Afghanistan, that has been cut to 30 to 40 trucks per day. And we're also told that there's a group called the Khyber Pass Transportation Association. The Khyber Pass Transportation Association says it's too dangerous to go across, and they don't want to do that anymore. They're fed up. They've had it with the Khyber Pass. So there's an attempt by the U.S. and the British to find ways to bring in the supplies by airlift into Central Asia, then by truck convoy into Afghanistan from the north. Big problems with that, though, because they don't have enough airlift. As long as it's seaborne transportation and truck convoys, they could possibly make it. But once they've got to rely on airlift into Central Asia, that makes it much, much harder, much, much more expensive. And we're going to see the inherent logistical weakness because of deindustrialization, because of these same Malthusian policies. You no longer have the logistical superiority, which is actually what gave the U.S. the edge, say, in World War II. Not so much that the upfront fighting forces were inherently superior, but that the logistics was so overwhelmingly superior that you had material superiority at every point where you wanted to have it. Well, that is gone. If you deindustrialize and go to a service economy in a post-industrial rubble field, then you don't have that anymore. And that is now what's showing up. But notice, the reason that these people in Afghanistan are so riled up is because of Barkey's own policy. Barkey demanded the bombing of northwest Pakistan. He got it. Bush fell in line with that, even though Bush, McCain, and even Clinton said no at the beginning. They decided that they would do it. And now the defeat in Afghanistan is going to be Obama's defeat. Obama's defeat in Pakistan, and who knows what will happen to this project to destroy Pakistan in the process. Now, this then gives us the supply crisis in Pakistan, gives us the outlines of what is quite possibly the first big crisis of the Obama regime. And if the truck convoys stay at the level of 30 to 40 today, in other words, one-tenth of what they need to be, then you're going to have a big crisis just about the time that Barkey gets into the White House, assuming it goes that far. Now, the other one is this. You've got to look at a website called rpmonitor.ru, rpmonitor.ru. They're very nice people. They've got an article of mine up there about the new Obama cabinet. Here's the thing. Remember the pipelines that take natural gas, methane and so forth, from Russia into Western Europe, to Germany, Italy, France, the rest of the continent. They go through Ukraine and Poland in many cases. Now, Ukraine, as a result of the kleptocracy of Comrade Yushchenko, put in by Brzezinski and Soros, is a bankrupt country. And they're bankrupt. Not only are they bankrupt, but their state gas company is bankrupt. That's Naftogaz. And the problem is that if Ukraine goes bankrupt, what's going to happen to the gas shipments? They're likely to be cut off. That will explode a crisis between Russia and Western Europe. Back in a minute.